Dear Ajahn, what role does destiny play in one's life? E.g., is anyone destined to be a monk, a successful leader? Exactly. Whoever wrote that question is destined to become a monk. No, you make your destiny. In other words, it's up to you. The future is in your hands. Don't blame destiny. Just take destiny in your hands and make your destiny. Isn't that exciting? That's why all the people who believe that on 21st of October 2012 will be the end of the world, it's destined to be so. You don't need to go home, do you? Waste of time going back if the world's going to end. You might as well stay here. Forget about your wife. Forget about your money. Forget about your kids. The world's going to end on the 21st of December. It's only a small time to go. Ah! It's wasting me, actually. I was supposed to be teaching a retreat in Kuala Lumpur. I better cancel that. No, it will not end. It's not destined to end. So that way we can just forget about that. Dear Ajahn, in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, that's a terrible book. Who wrote that? You taught this skillful means to use when you experience a delightful breath, but also starting to see a light nimitta. Imagine the breath is one end of the lotus petal, and a nimitta is the other, so you can keep mindful of both, or something like that. I am not a visual person, so I find it hard to get my head around this method. Could you please explain it in more detail? Here's an alternative skillful means you could recommend. That's one of the best. What I was saying in that simile of the thousand-petaled lotus is when you're in between stages, so you can see the breath, the delightful breath is opening up, you can see the nimitta inside, you can still see the delightful breath. In other words, two layers of petals. The outer one is opening up, but it's not fully opened yet. So you're in between the stage of delightful breath and the nimitta. It's like the nimitta's inside, and delightful breath, you can still feel it. So what do? Nothing. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Just make sure the mindfulness and kindness is still shining. And if it's meant to be, it will all open up and you'll just see the nimitta, delightful breath will disappear. If it's not the right time yet, like the lotus closes up and just left with a delightful breath again. Nimitta is gone. Doesn't matter, it will come again later on. So sometimes that's a very useful technique because it means you're in between stages. But it doesn't matter, just keep on doing exactly what you were doing before. Just being kind and being aware. That's all. So it keeps it very, very simple. In sitting meditation, we allow the inner system to function softly and gentle and calm down to stillness and emptiness, or not, with the releasing elements that always come along with them. Releasing elements always come along with going to still. It means that releasing the wind in your backside, because you ate beans this morning. Is that what it means? Or releasing the coughs? I should say something about coughing. Because, I think was it this morning, somebody ran out and they sort of coughed very loudly in the foyer over there, poor thing. Please remember that coughing should be done as soon as possible. Otherwise, we've got what we call in meditation the volcano effect. And we heard that this morning. When you try and restrain it, it's like keeping all the sort of the energy and the power in the volcano all plugged up. And you think, I mustn't cough because I'm going to disturb somebody. And you keep restraining and stopping it until eventually the power, the force builds up so much. And it's an incredibly loud noise. And worse than that, it sprays everybody around you, which is very unhealthy. So just when you feel like coughing, just cough. Thank you. And what that means is it's just natural, it's not a problem. But if you try and stop and control things, it really does become a big problem. Now what does it mean here? In sitting meditation we allow the inner system to function softly and gently, to calm down to stillness and emptiness, or not, with the releasing elements that always come along with them. I'm not quite sure what that means yet. You've asked a question which has stumped me. I cannot answer that because I don't know what you mean. So maybe, whoever wrote that, try again and I'll try and answer it the next time. Here we go again. Are the releasing elements come along with every inner body movements and breathing? Releasing elements? Don't know what releasing elements are. Try again. We have to set the mind with the releasing elements, so I'll leave that one. So I'm not sure what the releasing elements mean there, so please can you state that a bit more carefully. Can you please tell us when we get hooked into difficult mind states like judging, anxiety, confusion, criticism, why it's so hard to let go? It's as though there's a force behind these mind states that even though we experience the difficulty of them and want to be free from them, they latch on and won't let go. No, they don't latch on. You latch on to them. It's amazing how we can't let go of things. You know why we can't let go of them? Because they're mine. That's the reason why. There was the old story of how they used to catch monkeys in the jungle. They would find a coconut, eat it inside of the coconut, but just leave a small hole in the coconut shell, just big enough that a monkey could put their paw inside and out again. And they tie that coconut shell to a tree, and they'd leave a banana inside the coconut. And sure enough, a monkey would find that banana in the night time and would try and get the banana out. Remember, the hole is just big enough for a monkey to put their fist in. But when they grab a banana, it's too fat to get out. So the monkey can't get the banana out. And tries all night to get the banana out. Even though there's many other bananas in the forest. No, that's my banana. I found it. And even when the hunter comes, and the monkey sees the hunter coming, what does the monkey do? Tries even harder to get the banana out. And will the monkey let go and get his hand out and run away to freedom? No, because it's my banana. And monkeys get caught that way. So this is the problem with people. It's my problem. It's my husband. He's caused me all this trouble. It's my husband. You can't let it go. It's my kid. It's my work. It's whatever else it is. We can't let it go whenever we put this MY in front of it. That's why many of you come and tell me your problems. And I don't worry about them. It's not my problem. It's your problem. So it's wonderful. So same with you. It's not my problem. Whatever problem you have, it's your body's problem. Body doesn't belong to you. You're just renting it for 60, 70, 80 years, that's all. It's not my problem, it's body's problem. Look after yourself. Your mind is not your mind. It's mind doesn't belong to you, it's nothing to do with me. All the thoughts, the anger which comes up, whatever, it's nothing to do with me, not my problem. Somebody else's problem, that's it. So see, if you can take away the MY in front of all these problems, and then they're not my problem anymore, they're just problems. Nothing to do with me. And then you're free. Don't own anything. The more stuff you own, the more problems you have. And anyway, number two, where are those problems? Where do they live? What did he say here? What's that question? Where's the other question? It's gone. I don't know. I lost it anyway. It's not my problem. Yeah, it's gone anyway. Now, if you do have, where those problems live is always in the past or the future. Mostly they're in the past. What someone said to you, what they did, why they did it, that's called anger. And if you did it, that's called guilt. The past is finished. It's gone. Who knows who did what and why? As far as I'm concerned, it's totally ended. Isn't it wonderful that you can suddenly just drop the past immediately and it doesn't bother you again? The old story is, somebody calls you a dog. How do you react? Do you think, they call me a dog? They've got no right to call me a dog. That's a very rude thing to call me a dog. And if you're wise, you realize they have just called you a dog 3 more times. Every time you remember it, they're calling you a dog again. How stupid you are. For me, they can only call me a dog once. They call me a dog and I let it go. So they can only hurt me once. For you, they hurt you many times. They cheated you in business. They let you down in your marriage. How many times do you allow them to hurt you? Every time you remember it, he cheated on me. She scolded me. Every time you remember it, you're allowing them to hurt you one more time. It doesn't make any sense. So if they cheated in the relationship, if they cheated in business, it's not your karma. They did bad karma. Let them suffer. Me, I refuse to suffer. I'm not going to remember the stupid things you said or the bad things you did. I'm going to let it disappear in the past. It's not mine. It's your problem. That way you can let all those things of the past go. Especially speech. As I said the last time I was in Singapore, that is why you have 2 ears. One to go in, one to go out. So whenever I hear any bad words, criticism, putting down, I just keep all the ears open. They go in and go out, and they don't stay. If I hear praise, I always put one hand over my ear. So it can stay inside. Anything nice, anything good, keep one hand over your ear. That way, you're wise. You keep the good stuff of the past. So next time you have these thoughts coming in your head, all negativity, it's usually about the past. What are you doing that for? Why are you hurting yourself? Number 2, the future. As I said on the first night, I always love this saying because it really just reminds me. Now is the place my future is being made. Right now. This is creating my destiny. Right now. And if I'm just worried and afraid of what's going to happen next, I'm not paying any attention to making a positive future for myself. Every time you worry about the future, you're actually ruining it. Because you're not paying attention to the place the future is being made. So every time I start planning too much and thinking too much about the future, I realize I'm destroying the future. So I stay as much as possible in the present moment. And then you're free from all these thoughts and stuff. All the stuff which people sort of end up sort of causing themselves problems. Anyway, next question. How does one meditate when one starts coughing at various ingress? Yeah, you cough. You do coughing meditation. Do we welcome the cough to the doors of our hearts? Yes, of course you do. Thank you again. I know the Sister Chanda wanted me to tell this story. I hope you've forgotten since the last time I told this. I told this at the Khao Lak retreat. Actually, to tell this story, it's about time I told a ghost story. Can you please turn down the lights, Bert? Thank you so much. For those who remember this story, please be quiet. Come on, a few more. You can turn a few more off. More. No ghost will come in here with so many lights. That's up again. Okay, Daniel. I think I can't ask a Chinese person to turn down the lights because she's afraid of ghosts too. A Westerner, that's much spookier. Yeah. There was a man who came to my temple one evening for a Dhamma talk. He left about 10 p.m. and decided to walk home. It wasn't that far to his house, but the path went past the cemetery. And cemeteries, even here in Australia, are very, very spooky. Especially at night time, when there's a full moon and there's a wind. And sometimes you don't know, is that the sound of a kangaroo? Or is it something else? And I don't know why it is. I don't know if it's the same in Singapore. But in Australia, they have street lights. But when it's past the cemetery, the street lights are much further apart. It's always darker. But anyway, it was the closest way home. So he decided to take a chance. He walked past the cemetery late at night. No one was around. It's okay in Singapore. There's so many people and cars. In Australia, there's no one. And as he was walking past the cemetery, he got to halfway. He was safe. Nothing happened. But just after finishing the halfway mark, he thought, just thought, he heard somebody following him. He carried on walking, but paying full attention, and sure enough, he could swear that somebody was following him. If ever that happens to you, you daren't look around. Instead, you just try walking a bit faster. And when he was walking faster, whatever it was, also started walking faster. He'd only got to about 3/4 past the cemetery. And so he really started walking fast. And what was following him also walked fast. And then he could bear it no longer. He turned around to look. That was a big mistake. Because when he looked around, what he saw, you just would not believe. What he saw following him was a coffin. A vertical coffin with cobwebs and dirt dripping off it, following him down the road. Bump, bump, bump. And as soon as he saw that, he freaked out. No more walking fast. He ran for his life. But no matter how fast he ran, bump, 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 the coffin came running after him. Worse, that coffin was catching up. Fortunately, his house was very close by. So he didn't even open the latch of the gate. He jumped over it. And as he jumped over the gate, the coffin came too. And he got to his front door just as a coffin jumped over the gate too. He got out his keys to open the door. You know what happens? He dropped his keys. Bump, bump, bump. The coffin was getting closer. He just picked up the first key and put it in the lock. If that was me, it'd always be the wrong key. He was lucky. It was the right key. He turned the lock, opened the door, ran inside and slammed the door just as a coffin came to the door. He'd made it inside. He was sweating and panting. And he looked through the window of the door and he could see the coffin on the other side. Thump! Thump! As the coffin started to break down the door. Thump! Supernatural forces are very strong. The hinges started to give way. The wood started to splinter. Bump! It was only a matter of time when that spooky coffin would break down his door. He ran up the stairs to the only other room with a lock. And as he got to the top of the stairs, that was the bathroom. When he got to the top of the stairs, he looked around. Bump! As the coffin broke through the front door. And he could feel the coffin look at him as it turned around this way to find out where he was. And saw him at the top of the stairs. Bump, bump, bump. As his vertical coffin, still with cobwebs and dirt, started to climb the stairs. He put himself in the bathroom and locked the door. And put himself against the back wall as he heard the coffin come up the stairs and go bang against the bathroom door. Now your front door is much stronger than the bathroom door. He knew it was only a matter of seconds before that coffin would break through. And as the coffin broke through the door, he grabbed the first thing from the shelf he could reach. It was a bottle of medicine. And he threw it at the coffin! And you know what? The coffin stopped. Because what he threw was cough medicine. It stops the coffin. Thank you. That's a very bad joke, which I told at Calrac and Pinlag. But you can blame the nun over there because she asked me to tell it. Anyway, we learn meditation is a present and now. Nothing. What is contemplative meditation? Meditating upon a problem for a solution, or is that incorrectly used term meditation? Yeah, look, if you have a problem, forget about it. Stay in the present moment, make your mind very peaceful and still, and you find answers come up. One of those cases, there was a lady who came on a meditation retreat years ago, and she was some executive in the social work services in Perth, had a high position, lots of problems, dealing with very difficult cases. Very violent cases, rape cases, all sorts of social problems. And so when she came to the retreat, she was just really, really tired and exhausted. She also slept the first few days. And she told me she had these really important problems she had to solve by the next week. But she was wise enough to forget about them and just meditate. In the middle to the late retreat, she came to see me interview. She said, it was amazing. I'd totally forgotten about those problems, but as I was meditating, all these solutions, they just came up. And they're really good solutions to all these problems I have. And I wrote them down, and I'm going to forget about them now, but when I go back to work the next Monday, I'm going to put them into practice. They sound very good ideas. Said that is exactly how you find solutions. You go thinking about them and you'll never be able to make a decision. It gets too complicated. But you know, you have all the information programmed in your brain. Now let the brain do the work. Forget about it, be silent, be calm, and you'll find the answer will come to you. Especially during meditation. You're sitting here and then just this thought comes up. Wow, that's a solution to the problem. What a great solution that is. That's how it works. So if you do have problems, you don't want to contemplate something, program the question in your brain, leave it alone, don't think about it, and then the solution will come up.
Can you please tell us where we... Oh, that's a hook question. Can right view exist in any other religion apart from Buddhism? I think we did that one yesterday, didn't we? If Buddhism is the only one that teaches about anatta and dependent origination, or do other religions somehow teach this concept but by a different name? Okay. So if it is right view, people might call it Christianity, they might call it the follower of the great white ram, or whatever else they call it. But if it's right view, and the followers of the great white ram teach dependent origination and four noble truths, then it's Buddhism. That's why when I read my first book on Buddhism, I realized I was already a Buddhist. No one told me that before. So I had views about reincarnation, about karma, but I didn't realize it had a name called Buddhism. So where is dependent origination? Where is things like anatta and suffering? Doesn't matter what people call it. To me, that means Buddhism. So they can call themselves Catholics, they can call themselves Sufis, but it's Buddhist. Ajahn Brahm. Sometimes if I got quite peaceful during sitting meditation, I feel like I've lost my voice. At last, you're quiet. I wish everyone could do that. You're still talking too much. Never mind. Sometimes if I got quite peaceful during sitting meditation, I feel like I've lost my voice and can't do the chanting afterwards. If it's normal, great, there's plenty of other people to do the chanting. So you can just shut up. But I bet you find your voice when you see your friend afterwards. So try and lose your voice after the chanting. And if you lose your voice on this retreat, I will give it back to you in lost property before you go home again. So, you know, it's just all this talking. After a while, it's just so nice to be silent and not to have to talk to everybody, not have to listen, just to be without all this chatter. That's why I've known many, many people, especially when they've been married before, they're silent. They're so angry at each other, they decide they're not going to speak to one another. No, that sometimes you know each other so well that you don't need to have words. That's why people can be very peaceful. Sometimes if I got peaceful, I lose my appetite, so I eat little at lunch, but then hungry later. Why does this happen? It's because that you have another form of happiness. Most people eat not because they need it, but because they like to eat. Now, it's social, it's enjoyable. But when you get into deep meditation, you get so happy you don't need to eat. Who wants food when you're having fun? So that's what's happening there. You're just getting satisfied with meditation, which means you don't really need to eat. And later on, you don't die through not eating one meal. I've never yet had anybody who fasted for one day on this retreat die on me. We think we're going to die. Oh, I'm not going to eat today, I'm going to die. No, of course you don't. So don't be afraid. If you miss a meal, that's fine. If you're a little bit hungry, don't mind. It's good practice for you. Many people in the world are hungry every day, so sometimes it's good for you to feel hungry so you know what it's like. And then you can just eat double breakfast tomorrow. It's actually quite a nice breakfast tomorrow, so you're making it. So sometimes all it means is because you're getting peaceful, because you're getting content and happy, you don't need all these other things. So it's quite natural that when you meditate a lot, you don't feel like eating very much. Why can monks eat cheese in the afternoon but not drink milk? We don't drink milk because we're not cows. And we eat cheese because we're monks. I don't know. You've got to draw the line somewhere in life. And in our tradition, they drew the line, you can have cheese, but you can't have milk. Over in Bodhinyana monastery, we've got a different line. You can't eat cheese over in Bodhinyana or milk. That's why many monks come here in the evening to listen to the talk, so they can listen. No, that's not true, that's not true. So it's just, that's where we draw the line somewhere. To those who made the special breakfast, thank you so much. I've not had congee with pickles for so long, at least a week. Wonderful, thank you. So they really enjoyed that. Well done. So it's nice actually not just having questions but having compliments too. Dear Ajahn, I dreamt that a friend was doing the book sales in Singapore. And true enough, she had book sales in Singapore the same day. Does our mind travel through distance as well? Sometimes you have many dreams. And sometimes those dreams come true. Most of the time, they don't. And if they do, sometimes we don't really know what they mean. Do you remember that old story, it's in Open the Door of Your Heart, about the man who dreamt of the four angels? Some of you obviously haven't heard that. There's a fellow here in Perth. He had one of these dreams at night of four angels. And the angels, no sorry, five angels. And those five angels, in his dream, queued up and presented him with five pots of gold each. Worth a fortune, 25 pots of gold. And when he woke up, he looked around his room and couldn't see any angels. He didn't mind that, but he was pretty disappointed there were no pots of gold. But anyways, one of those dreams. And when he went down into the kitchen for his breakfast, he found that that morning his wife had made him five pieces of toast and five boiled eggs. He started to wonder about this number five. And you can imagine what he thought when he looked at the newspaper and found it was the 5th of May, the 5th day of the 5th month. This must be a sign. So he looked at the horse racing. And there is a horse, there's a race course here in Perth named after a famous one in England called Ascot, A-S-C-O-T. And so he looked at the racing in Ascot that day and he couldn't believe his eyes when he saw in race number five, horse number five, you know what it was called? Five Angels. The horse called Five Angels was running that day, race number five, horse number five. And he had all his dreams about the number five. So it had to be a premonition. So he never told his wife. I say that women don't understand these things. So he went to his bank, took $5,000 out. Now to keep the lucky number five, you only have these chances once in a life, if you have any chances at all like that, these dreams. He took $5,000 out. He went to the horse racing track. You know, he'd have these people you put the bets on, the bookmakers. He chose the 5th one in line to keep, you know, the lucky number five. And he put $5,000 to win on horse number five, race number five, Five Angels. He knew the lucky number five could not be wrong. It wasn't wrong. His horse came in 5th. That's what happens with dreams. Sometimes only afterwards you understand what they meant. By that time you lost $5,000. Actually, there was a similar dream. There was, I don't mind telling who this is because some of you know Gus and Julie who come here. And they come on a Thursday. Gus and Julie? Charles? They were here last Thursday anyway. So Julie, she's from Singapore. Gus, he's from England. He was working in the army there, I think a dental technician, when they met and they fell in love and got married. And they came to move in Perth. They've been all together now for years and years. But he said one day he was visiting his family, you know, his wife's family in Singapore somewhere. I think they live close to Pali Lai Temple. Well, what's that area called? Badok, that's right, in Badok. So the family live in Badok. So, now she was talking to her sisters, yak, 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 yak. He was getting bored, silly. And his brothers-in-law saw that he was getting bored, and so he said, look, we're going to the racetrack this afternoon. Do you want to come with us? And he's not a gambling man, but he thought, well, you know, nothing else to do. So he went. And of course, his in-laws, being Chinese Buddhists, they had to go to the temple first of all. To light some incense for good luck. But I don't know what temple they went to, but when they went to it, it was a bit of a mess. So they managed to find some brooms and a mop or something. They cleaned it up first of all. And that's really important. I'd say, no, one who does the cleaning is closest to the Buddha, you know. Closest to the Buddha. So they cleaned up the temple, and then they lit their incense, prayed for luck, and they went to the racetrack. You know what happened? They'd all lost. But that night, this English man had a dream of going to the racetrack and betting on a horse and winning. And, you know, it was one of those dreams where you remember the details. And again, when he looked in the Straits Times, the name of that horse which he dreamt of was actually running that afternoon. This was no joke. He was running. He remembered the name. He looked at it just to see, and it was running. So he rang up his brothers-in-law and said, you know, we lost yesterday. But it must be because we cleaned up that temple. I had a dream. A dream of this horse winning, and that horse is running today. Let's go to the racetrack and recoup our losses. You know what the brothers-in-law said? You're an Ang Mo. No way would a spirit in a Singapore temple tell you. An Ang Mo means like a Westerner. They won't tell you, you know, who's going to win. They tell us first. And so he went by himself. He put a lot of money on that horse. It won, and his brothers-in-law were so upset afterwards. They weren't upset at this Westerner. They were upset, these temple devas, they look after the Ang Mos, they just go in there once, and people actually live in Singapore. They don't care about them. That's a true story. So the temple deva told the Ang Mo they wouldn't tell any of the Singaporeans who's going to win. So the answer is, if you do go gambling, take an Ang Mo to the temple. Dear Ajahn, when we are in retreat, is it all right to be not busy with duties and so easy once we're back to the when we are in retreat, it's all right not to be busy with duties, but not so easy once we're back to the mundane world. Like even here, there's a little few duties which you have. And you can always volunteer for a few more. Yeah, even just like a few people sweeping off the bugs in front of the pathway over here. That's not your duty, but it's a nice thing to do. It's nice to help cook the breakfast for people or just, you know, serve someone or help them. That's not your job, but it's a nice thing to do. Now, if you practice that degree of kindness and letting go and looking after one another, that will really help you in the world outside. When you become a very kind person, you help other people, they will help you. Another story, I don't think I told this for a long time now. One of the people came to see me here in Perth to tell me this story. You know, he went through a divorce, like many Australian people do these days, and it was very difficult for him because his wife got all the property, he got all the debts. And he was living in a small apartment, the poor fellow. So he had to start from scratch again, and he started a little business which was selling these calendars, you know, with advertising on. And he was a one-man business, but he was actually surviving reasonably well. But during the divorce, he had a pedigree dog he had to get rid of, and so he found a woman who had a dog of the same species and managed to give it to her. And so this elderly woman and him formed a little friendship. And one day this woman asked him, he said, look, you know, I need to go to the doctors today. You know, there's no car can take me. Would you mind? You know, you've got your own business. You can take a few minutes off. Would you mind taking me? And he was so kind. He said, yeah, sure, I can take half an hour off. It's a good break for my business. So, you know, he drove her to the doctors, waited for her, then drove her back again. Public transport is not so good in Perth. And that started a regular thing. Whenever she needed, you know, to go to the dentist or needed to go somewhere, you know, if it was really necessary, she'd give him a call. He'd drop what he was doing and take her because he quite liked her. They were friendly. And that had gone on for about 6 months. I just know someone being kind when they didn't really need to. And then she rang him and said, look, I've really got to go into Perth today. I've got some appointment. Would you mind taking me? Sure, no trouble. He picked her up and took her. He was going to his lawyer, her lawyer. And usually he'd wait outside for her. But she said, oh, no, no. Can you please come upstairs, you know, into the lawyer's office with me? I need you to do something. And so he followed her up into the lawyer's office. And there she made him the sole beneficiary of her will, which was substantial. She died a few months later, and now he's mega rich. And he came and told me about that. He said, I was just helping somebody, just being kind, and now I've inherited all this money. Now that is what happens when you're kind to people. Karma works. So, if you want to be rich, go and serve somebody. So that's actually how, you know, helping somebody even on this retreat, you know, going out to get some extra carrots or soy milk, whatever you need, doing things like that, that's where you get rich from. So here you're learning service. Small little things. And it's not duties, you're just doing it because you want to do it. It's not because you have to. You learn that here, and that really helps you out in the big world. Dear Ajahn, in the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dead. Living and dying, isn't it? I was living and dead. More ghost stories. They taught on the point of death one should follow the light to guard against being reborn in the lower realm. Thanks for enlightening us to that light is nimitta. My relations are unlikely to any meditation in this lifetime. What advice can I give them about the point of death besides following the light? On their bedside, just before they die, get a flashlight and shine it in. So follow the light. Well, it might work. No. What give them on the point of death is, number one, give them permission to die. It's all right to die. Come on, Mum, off you go. In other words, a lot of time people struggle at the point of death. They're ready to die, but they don't want to make their relations so sad. Imagine that, you know, you're a mother and your kids are by your bedside. And you're very, very concerned that you don't want to cause so much sadness. And your kids are crying, Mom, Mom, please don't go, please don't leave us. Imagine what that does to someone dying. So one of the wonderful things to do is when you know the relation has gone past the point of no return, they're going to die, give them permission. Say, it's all right, Dad. You know, you've done a wonderful job, made a wonderful family, please, you can go with our blessing. That means a lot to the person who's dying. They feel free to die, knowing they're not going to upset and cause suffering to the people they love the most. So give them permission to die is number one. And number two, as they're dying, just tell them again to let go of the past. Don't carry around all these bad things and feelings which you may have done, or anger to others who may have been cruel to you. It's not the time to do that. Instead, remember all the wonderful things they've done, all the happy moments of their life. Because if you, just like if you go into sleep with happy thoughts, you have a very beautiful sleep. If you go into sleep with worries and concern, you know, you have nightmares sometimes. So what you take into the death state with you will determine how you get reborn. And so just things which they like to do. And if any of you, you know, have these experiences that you do in Singapore, Malaysia, where have these crazy fundamentalist evangelicals come to your bedside to try and convert you. Now that's so difficult to bear. Because, you know, you're trying to die and they're coming up with all these arguments, you must convert, believe in Jesus or whatever. So I've given this advice for a long time now. If that's you dying, and maybe, you know, your son or your daughter's become a Christian, tries to convert you, please convert. Convert. Say, I'm a Christian now. Because that's the only way you get them out of the room. And once they're out of the room, convert back to being a Buddhist. Well, you can convert one way, you can convert back again. And that's the only way to get rid of them. And then you can die peacefully. So, And so give them permission, give them positive mind. That's one of the best things you can do. And if they haven't meditated before, it doesn't matter. Just remind them they're good people. They've got nothing to be afraid of. What else can we do for loved ones besides encourage them to meditate so they can be guided to a good rebirth? Sometimes, that you know what it's like when maybe you're taking your parents to the airport and you say, "Mum, I'll check in for you." And you find your mother's flying economy class. It's your mother. She's old. So you go to the counter and say, "How much is it to upgrade to business?" And you pay, you know, quite a lot of dollars. You say, "Mum, I've upgraded you. Thank you, darling." It's a nice thing to do to your mum if you can afford it. So, that's sometimes what we can do when people are dying. Your mother's only got a certain amount of karma, but you do some good karma pretty quickly. That's like upgrading your mother's karma. You know, you do some ceremony, do some charity, and share the merits to your mother who's dying. That's like taking her plane ticket and upgrading it to business. Or if you really do a lot of charity, what is it in Singapore Airlines? Sweets? You send your mother sweet class to heaven. So you can actually upgrade people a little bit to make them a sort of a better rebirth. That's called sharing of merits. That's a very good thing to do. That actually works. So those are the things you can do when somebody's dying. Dear Ajahn Brahma, does the first jhana begin when you start seeing the light? No, not yet. People really like jhanas. They're saying, "Oh, please, please say it is. Because I've seen the light, but I haven't got jhana yet, and I really want jhana. Please, please, please say it is." No. Dear Ajahn Brahma, I'm beginning to get the hang of walking meditation now, but how do we continue to do that walking to the MRT, etc. in Singapore? Simple. Just as the train is waiting in the station, you don't run, you're just lifting the foot up. Moving it forward, lifting it down. And as the doors close, you notice doors closing, doors closing. No, if you have to run, run. Sometimes people are stupid with meditating. I went to this conference once. Where was it? I think it was in Vietnam, I think. And there was a panel. And one person had to go to the lectern to give a presentation. 15 minutes was all we had. You know, in conferences, you can't go on forever. Everyone was allowed 15 minutes. So this was one of these meditators where he said, "Now it is your turn to give your presentation." And she rose up from her seat really mindfully. And she walked mindfully to the lectern. By the time she got there, 5 minutes had already gone. And then she started to read her speech. "Dear conference members, I am now..." And that was the end of her speech, because she had to walk back, which would take another 5 minutes. That's almost actually what happened. It was crazy. So remember, it's not just walking slow, it's walking naturally. Here you can walk as slow as you like. But if there's a fire here, you don't walk slowly. You get out as fast as you can. So that's how you walk to the MRT, fast. If it's really tough, remember to be mindful when you're rushing around with tasks to complete. Can you please give us some pointers? Thank you. Yeah, one task at a time. I've often noticed, what are busy people? Busy people when you're doing too many things at the same time. But to be an efficient person, you do one thing, do it well, then the next thing. It's amazing how much you get done by the end of the day. You know, I think the monks can say, "I get a lot done every day. I have huge amounts of responsibilities and duties. Even here, I'm teaching a retreat to you, doing a ceremony over in Bodhinyana today, counseling people after lunch. What else was I doing today? Oh yes, yeah, just doing all the email correspondence and also some of the finances for our Buddhist society, making sure everything's going well, as well as teaching the retreat and doing all sorts of other stuff. It's amazing how much I get done in one day. You can do that because one thing at a time and do it well. I know that some years ago, I remember giving a talk, I think it was it the Buddhist Union in Singapore? They had a talk at that World Trade Center next to the harbour. And I gave a talk there. And I always remember this. I gave a talk about the usual stuff I talk. And then at question time, this man said, he said, "That's all very well, Ajahn Brahm, but you're a monk. You don't have to experience stress like I have to." And then I got the microphone to respond to him. And I said, "This is what I've been doing today." And I went through since, I think, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. That was about 10 o'clock at night, without any rest. And all the stuff I've been doing just in one day in Singapore. And he said, "Look, I work really hard." And then he got the microphone again and said, "Look, I'm surprised. I never realized how hard a monk has to work." He said, "I always wanted to become a monk one day, but not now." And I thought, "Oh no, I lost one." So that's how you can become efficient without being stressed. You know the story which I've told you, that how heavy is the cup? I told this, by this time last year I was in England, and I gave this talk at Imperial College in London to a group of scientists. And you've heard me do this demonstration before. How heavy is a cup? And one of them said about 220 grams. Scientists. That's not what I mean. So the longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. When it gets painful, what should you do? Put it down and rest for a bit. So you put it down for 20 seconds. When you pick it up again afterwards, it feels light. You can carry it without any stress. So this is how you deal with stress at the workplace. Stop holding the burden. When you're tired, rest for goodness sake. And after you've rested, you carry on working. Yeah, you've lost a few minutes when you're resting. You make up those minutes afterwards with greater productivity. You are more efficient. I've told that so many times. And just last week we had, I taught it at the World Computer Conference in Brisbane, and the organisers came to visit last Thursday, and Mr. Wong and Johan. And they said that, well, I knew they said it was still a very popular talk. That's why they came to visit again while they were in Perth, and they said it was put from the conference onto the Australian, which is a national newspaper here in Australia. And from there, according to Dania, it went on the Australian Stock Exchange site. And from there, it went on Harvard Business School blog. So you see, you hear it first, here. Before Harvard, they get all of their stuff from China Grove. You go to the stores. It's actually just efficiency. So that's how you deal with busyness. When you get tired, put it down and rest. You make more time that way. "Please can you explain how serving others can help deepen our meditation when it can be a distraction from facing our own stuff? Thanks." Very nice question. One of the first times I understood this was in Thailand. There were some monks, they were making their robes to ordain. When you ordain in Thailand in those days, you had to make all your set of three robes. Now, if those of you who stay for Katini, you can see these robes, they're very big. We had to start with white cloth, cut it, sew it, and then wash it, and then make the dye from jackfruit wood, chopping it up, boiling it, until you had enough sap to dye the robes. You had to dye them 3 or 4 times. You couldn't leave them because the dye would run. You had to keep turning the robes every 5 minutes so the dye would be even. It was a process which took about 3 or 4 days. And so some of my friends, I was already a monk, some of my friends were doing this. They'd already been without sleep for about 36 hours. And now they're facing another night without sleep. So I broke the rule. I went to the dyeing shed after the evening service, maybe about 9:30, 10 o'clock. And I said, you guys go and have a rest. I'll look after the diapot for you tonight. They didn't argue. They went straight away. Because you know what it's like? You haven't slept for 36 hours, 40 hours. You feel terrible. So I looked after the diapot all night. And when the bell went at 3 o'clock in the morning, they came back. And I didn't go and sleep. I went for the morning chanting so no one would know I was helping them out and breaking the rule. And that morning I was so bright. Meditation very clear, lots of energy for the chanting. When I went on arms round, I wasn't tired at all. And I was so shocked that even though I hadn't slept, I was so fully awake and meditation was so good, I had to ask the abbot, who was Ajahn Sumedho at that time. I confess, look, I'm sorry, but I felt so much compassion for those monks. They hadn't slept. You know, I did the work for them that night. And the funny thing was, I was just so energized by that, not sleepy at all. And he explained to me, exactly, that's what happens when you serve others. You get this big boost of energy. And it's beautiful energy, so you get great meditation. That was the first time. I should have been tired, but I wasn't. Because you've served others out of compassion. Knowing that, I'm very happy to serve as a monk. I've done that all my life. And I get huge, great meditation as a result. If you are just thinking of your own meditation and not doing any service at all, just in your room or in here, meditating, without any service, you're unbalanced. You find your meditation doesn't have the oomph. I know that from my own practice. And I know that for some other monks who've had just wonderful good karma, to go into the mountains and forests, no duties at all, be looked after. Their meditation is nowhere near as good as mine. Why is that? Because I can also do some service. It makes the heart very powerful. So don't... I know that so much that sometimes that I fight. I used to fight other monks. Let me do it. I want to do the service. It wasn't saying, no, it's your turn this today. You're on the kitchen cleanup tomorrow. You're on it the next day. No, he said, I'm going to do the whole lot. And you do that, and it actually works. You get incredible, powerful meditation. You may not have as much time as others to meditate, but the quality of your meditation really goes up. And it makes life much more fun when you're fighting who's going to cut up the carrot. Give it to me. No, it's my turn. No, I'll cut it. Come on. This is a serious and deep question. Okay, I don't do serious questions. Now, this is probably a joke. Where do we fix our eyeballs when we are experiencing peaceful breath and white light start to appear? You fix your eyeballs in your eye sockets. Don't let them come out. Just let the eyeballs be where the eyeballs want to be. If they want to come out, they can come out. In other words, don't control. When the white lights start to appear, when we follow the lights, our eyelids start to flutter and disturb the peace. If we do not follow, we can't see. Just forget about the eyes, because that light you're not seeing with the physical eye. You're seeing it with the mind, the mind's eye. This is a mental object, these beautiful lights. It doesn't matter whether you've got the lights on or the lights off. The lights are there. That's why Claire has... Is that those ones which I gave you last time? She's got these eye shades from Singapore Airlines, which she uses. I wore them once, so they're holy eye shades. And it means that, you know, you don't have to worry about the eyes fluttering. You just put the shades on, they're very comfortable. And then also, you know, if a nimitta comes up, you've got the shades on, it can't be a light from the sun or anything, it has to be the real one. And it means your eyes are just, they're not doing anything, they're just relaxing. So don't worry about your eyelids. Or your eyeballs, they're not seeing anything. What's seeing it is the mind. Does Buddhist practice reduce global warming and help save the environment? Indeed. One of the biggest problems of the environment, one of the biggest causes of global warming is our population. The monks here, we're doing our bit to limit the population explosion. We're not having any kids. So this is one of the big problems. Whenever there's an explosion of the population, everybody wants to live a good life and to travel, which means that's where the global warming comes from. So my solution for global warming is every second man should become a monk, every second woman should become a nun, and those monasteries should be subsidized by all the governments of our world, which is much cheaper than just reducing all these other greenhouse gases. And when there's hardly any children around, then it means there won't be so much global warming. How many of you travel around the world to see your children? When there's no much children, you won't have to travel so far. But and monks live very simply. We don't have big houses which create so much greenhouse gases. So live very simply, become a monk, become a nun, and that's my solution to save the environment and to save global warming. Is that a good idea? I'm doing my bit. You know what goes well with durian? Some glutinous rice and coconut milk and some mangoes. Not too much though. Might give you indigestion. Talking about indigestion, this is a great question. Talking about indigestion, I keep thinking of my ex-girlfriend whenever I meditate. I tried making a deal with my mind, but it didn't work. She even brought her friends into my head and started gossiping about me. Wow, that's so profound. You know that when I used to go into town every Friday to give the talk, the way we used to go would always pass an ice cream van. And every time in the afternoon I saw the ice cream van through the window of the car, I thought, I'd love an ice cream. But it was in the afternoon. And we can't eat ice cream in the afternoon. But then whenever I got ice cream in the morning for the meal, I never had it. And I started thinking, hang on, why is it that ice cream appears more delicious in the afternoon when I can't have it? But when I can have it, it's not so important. That's why you're thinking of durian, because here you can't have it. That's why you're thinking of your girlfriend, because here you can't have her. We keep 8 precepts. Isn't it interesting when we can't have things, that's when we think about them. That is why there was this old farmer years ago, and he had all this mouldy hay. The rain had come and the hay was mouldy. And farmers, they have to cut costs, so he tried to get his cows to eat the mouldy hay. And even though the cows were hungry, they refused to eat that hay. So he thought he'd mix the mouldy hay with fresh hay. And of course what the cows did, they separated it out, they ate the good hay, and they left the mouldy hay. And he didn't know how to get rid of this mouldy hay until he noticed something. If you go to any farms, you'll see this. In the paddocks where the cows graze in the fields, they've always got a fence around it. And you always see the cows pushing their heads through the fence to eat the grass just on the other side of the fence. So when he saw that, all he did was put the mouldy hay not inside the paddock, but outside the paddock, beyond the fence, but not too far, so a cow could actually stretch and get that hay. And that was gone within a day. This is psychology. If you make it prohibited, but you can just reach it if you really can, then it becomes very enticing. So that's actually just how we get people to meditate. Tell them not to. And then they might. Or how that story of this Malaysian girl here in Perth, and her Australian husband was a good man, but he was not interested in religion. So she came to me and said, look, how can I get my husband to come to the temple? I'm sure he would like it. He needs it. But every time I say, come to the Buddhist temple, he says, no way, I hate religion. I said, look, it's really easy to get your husband interested. All you need to do is buy a copy of my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, take it home, and when your husband sees it, tell him, keep your hands off this, it's mine. Prohibit him from reading it. So she did that. When she bought a book, took it home, which is her husband, keep your hands off this, It's mine, I don't want you to touch it. It's holy, okay? Don't touch it. You tell that to a husband, it's obvious what he's going to do. As soon as she's out shopping, what do you mean I can't touch it? So he opened it up, read the first story, and didn't put it down until he read the last. And now he comes every week. That's how you do these things. And that's why you're thinking about durian and glutinous rice, because we haven't got any here. If you're back home, you have so much, you probably wouldn't even bother about it. So that's what happens. And why you think about your girlfriend is because she's not here. But if it really is a problem, you always, whenever you go on a retreat, you think of your girlfriend. There is a solution. This is adapted for Ajahn Chah's story. You know what's coming, don't you? And that is, you know, because, you know, you'll miss her when you come on a retreat. You want to have something of hers to remind you of her when she's absent. Just like when you go overseas, you take a picture of her so when you miss her, you can see your girlfriend. Or even better, it's like, take, you know, a lock of her hair. Or a piece of her dress with her scent so when you miss your girlfriend, ah, it's my girlfriend. But the Buddhist way is to get something even more intimate from your girlfriend. Ask her for a bottle of her shit. And then when you come to Jhana Grove for a retreat next time, when you start thinking about your girlfriend, when you miss her, open the bottle. Oh, that's my girlfriend. And that will stop all of that business. Don't you love everything about her? Not everything. Ajahn Brahm, when I meditate, I saw my body decay. Some of you are so old, I just need to open my eyes. When I meditate, I saw my body decay. I saw worms, but this is really good. I saw worms burrowing through my body. I could feel the sensations and just noted it. This is impermanent. Is this what is meant by insight? Now, sometimes that is an insight to notice that one day your body will be like that. You'll be in a box, buried in the ground, with all these worms eating it. Yuck. And the girl which you like the most, the hottest chick, the cutest guy, they will end up like that too. It reminds me of a story about the hypochondriac. There was this hypochondriac in Perth, and he'd go and see the doctor every second day. He said, I've got SARS. There's no SARS in Perth. Oh, okay, fair enough. Go the next day, it must be malaria. No, you don't have malaria in Perth. Go the next day, it must be the plague I've got. Whatever he read about in the paper, he thought he had, so he was like hypochondriac. And so after a while, the doctor just got fed up with this guy, decided to try, you know, tough love. So when this man came in, he didn't give him any tests, he said he had some weird disease. He said, you are not sick, you're perfectly healthy, all your tests come up positive, you're fine. It's hypochondriac, it's in your mind, you stupid guy. Get out of here. And he was so tough on this patient, the patient was shocked. And he staggered out of the surgery, totally shocked at the behaviour of this doctor. He went across the road without looking, got hit by a car and killed. And when the doctor heard the sound of the accident, he ran out too to try and help. When he realized that he was responsible by being too tough on this poor hypochondriac, the doctor had a heart attack and died as well. And so because they died one after the other, they were buried in adjacent plots at the cemetery, right next to each other. And the doctor was only buried for 2 days when he heard a knock on his coffin. It was his neighbour, the hypochondriac. And the hypochondriac said, doctor, doctor, have you got anything for worms? So that's actually good. It means you're noticing the permanence of the body. That's good. The stream of consciousness is reborn. Is this the mind? Yeah, you can call it the mind. Why is the mind overpowered by the the something and will, by the brain and will. Thank you, your nothingness. That's a good question, because now when the mind separates from the brain at death, number one, it's happy, it's peaceful. And, you know, actually the mind can actually see and think much more clearly. I know this because, you know that my mother died in February. She had Alzheimer's disease for 2 or 3 years. And I know this because I know my meditation. I saw articles about this as well. When a person has Alzheimer's disease, they can't recognize anybody. They don't know who is who. My mother never recognized myself or my brother at all. But I wasn't with her when she died, because I was in Australia. But I would have known. The last 5 minutes, if I had been by her bedside, even though she hadn't recognized me for 3 years, the last 5 minutes she would have recognized me. All the memories would come back once the mind separates from the brain. And that's been the case for quite a few people, reported that their mother or father's had Alzheimer's for years, and then they suddenly come clear. Oh, hi, Jackson, how are you? Where have you been? How's everything? You know, how's the wife going? They remember because the mind separates from the brain, and then they die. It's very, very common that happens. And then the mind goes back, you know, with a full memory when it goes into the body for the next life. But then it sort of loses it again, as it becomes a kid again. And somehow the brain sort of covers up all the memories from the past life, which the mind carries into the next life. But you can access those memories through meditation. And you can actually bypass the brain so the mind can be very clear. And that's why sometimes there's some memories which you've forgotten and you can't recall. But under hypnosis, which is another way of accessing the mind, you can actually remember all those things. It's fascinating to see the difference between the mind and the brain. There's one documentary somebody showed me about this poor English guy who'd suddenly lost his memory and couldn't remember why. It's as if everything from one particular time had been totally wiped from his conscious memory. And the problem was he just got remarried about 3 or 4 months before this. And his poor young wife, you know, he didn't recognize her, didn't know who she was. And they've only just recently been married. And the doctors could find nothing wrong with him. No CT scans of the brain, everything was perfectly normal. They couldn't know why this happened. And so this was a BBC documentary. And they gave this guy a hypnotherapy. And they hypnotized him and to see if he could regress and find out what happened. And under hypnosis, he could remember everything. What he was doing, he was working in the shed in the back of his house. In those days before cell phones, you know, the landline in his house rang. He rushed out to answer the phone. The shutter of the shed was open. He hit his head on the shutter. And it knocked everything out of his brain. And that's why he couldn't remember anything. Under hypnosis, he could remember everything. And the hypnotist gave him the post-hypnotic suggestion, you will remember everything once I take you out of hypnosis. They took him out of hypnosis, he couldn't remember anything. Still, all that past was gone. Under hypnosis, he could remember everything. Which actually shows us the difference between the storage of memory in the brain and the storage of memory in the mind. So if we can access the mind, it's much better. So the stream of consciousness is the mind, which gets reborn, but it does get overpowered by the brain. But you can actually restore that clarity through some meditation. Uh-oh, this is scary. Now that it is a special full moon, can you tell us a vampire story to scare us all silly into staying up to meditate all night, or a ghost story? I've already told the story of the coffin ghost. Shall we have another ghost story? Or is it too much for one night? No? Okay, he was shaking the head. Okay, we'll do another ghost story tomorrow night. I'm upset. I can't seem to let go of pleasant, peaceful experiences. And I don't like doing what I don't like. Please answer seriously. I can't seem to let go of pleasant, peaceful experiences. and I don't like doing what I don't like. Okay. So you can open your heart to being upset. It's nice to be upset. You might get some sympathy from someone. Tell somebody you're upset, and then I'll give you some extra breakfast tomorrow morning to cheer you up. You can't seem to let go of pleasant, peaceful experiences. Hang on, that doesn't make sense to me. Because if you can't let go of things, they're not pleasant or peaceful. You don't like doing what you don't like. That makes sense to me. So see if you can like what you don't like. When you like what you don't like, then you won't not do what you don't like not doing. And that way, if you're not confused... In other words, stop thinking too much. Today while I was walking, a thought came into my mind. I mocked at the thought. It hunts. It hurts. And mocked at the thought. It hunts. Later I apologized to that thought. Oh, it hurts. I apologized to that thought. I felt a stream of good feeling. However, I turned away from it and a good feeling stopped. Oh my God, this is life. That is the life I was living. Later when I chant the Metta Sutta, don't despise any thought in any state. I really wanted to cry. That's actually quite nice. That's actually very profound. It means any thought, any feeling, even being upset, don't despise being upset. Open the door of your heart to the different seasons of your life. Being upset, being happy, being miserable, being joyful, being healthy, being sick. It's all part of life. I often say it's when it's difficult, that's when we have to work. When it's easy, that's when we relax. I gave that simile about the 70% rule. 70% rule was when I was a school teacher, I had to set an exam, and I was advised to set the exam to be not too hard, not too easy. So the average score would be 70%. So I said, this is mathematics, because if everybody only got maybe average score 30%, 40%, the students would lose their motivation. They'd all think they couldn't do maths, simply because I set too hard a test. But if everyone got 95%, 100%, it would be not worth doing, too easy. But 70% was what I should aim for. Because if the average score was 70%, most of the children would be motivated. Yeah, they could do maths. 70%, that's a good score. But the 30% where they made mistakes, that was where I, their teacher, could see where their weaknesses were and address those weaknesses in the next couple of lessons. That way I was motivating them, but also finding out what they needed to know. So 70% was the best. And I realized that's the same in life as well. If you always get 100% in life, you have no problems or difficulties at all. It means you learn nothing. But if you have so many failures in life, you only score 30%, you get depressed. 70% is just right. You get encouraged, you're having happiness, but you're having some difficulties as well. That's where you learn. Same with your husband. If your husband only scores 70%, you know, it's pretty good, but you know, 30% he needs correcting. He's the perfect husband. If he only scores 20%, you better get a new one, quick. If he scores 100%, it's a waste of time. It makes you feel so inferior. So 70% is the best. And it's the same in meditation. If every meditation you get jhana, what are you learning? 70% is the number one score. So that way, you understand that you have a thought, you can be happy with the thoughts. You can respect them. Even failure. You don't despise failure. The 30% when it doesn't work. Because that's where you learn. That way, you can open up your heart to the whole of life, whatever happens. And that way you can be at peace with everything. When it's difficult, that's where you learn. It's called growing pain. When it's easy, that's where you're getting the rewards from all your hard work. So enjoy it. So there, oh my goodness, it's 9:23. And I did tell the coffin joke. So there's no coffins here. So you're quite safe to walk back to your huts. You're perfectly safe. So those are the questions for this evening. I do apologize for the two or three bad jokes.